Good afternoon. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Celia Menschel, chair of the club's member-led Middle East Forum. A special welcome to new members and to any students. Would you please be sure your cell phones are off? This program is being recorded for possible broadcast. And we really encourage and appreciate your questions, but please use the question cards on your seats. I'll be picking them up throughout the program. I'd like to mention a few upcoming Middle East Forum programs. On October 25th, Dr. Nahid Anga, co-founder of the International Association for Sufism, will talk about Sufism, the mysticism of Islam, with Michael Pappas, the executive director of the San Francisco Interfaith Council. Please note, there's a beautiful flyer. The artwork is done by Salma Aristu, a wonderful local artist. On November the 9th, Karaman Mamand Farouj will be talking about the Kurds, human rights and self-determination with Joel Brinkley, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and professor of journalism at Stanford University. He's also an expert on the Middle East and, as many of you know, has spoken at the club before and has a column in the Chronicle. Karaman is a lawyer from Kurdistan. He's barely 30. He's an activist. He's studying international legal systems at Golden Gate University. And on December the 7th, Dr. Mawia Barazangi, professor emeritus at Cornell University. His PhD is in seismology, but he's also done a lot of research and educating. He's going to talk about oil, earthquakes, and the decline of science in Arabia. He was educated primarily in Syria, and he believes that the West really needs to understand Islamic, Arabic, Persian cultures, and he'll talk about that with Dr. Richard Cardwell, a former senior geophysicist at Chevron. To find out more about that and other upcoming programs, you can go to commonwealthclub.org or check out the club's wonderful magazine if you're a member. It's a great perk. And if you were a member today, it would be free. So I'll recommend that. There'll be a book signing following the presentation. The books are for sale outside, but we'll be signing them inside. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Dina Ibrahim. She is a professor of broadcast, and electronic communication arts at San Francisco State University. Dr. Ibrahim earned her degrees in journalism and Middle East studies at the American University in Cairo. She has a PhD in journalism from the University of Texas. She's appeared on CNN, BBC, NPR, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I want to make a special thank you because this is the third program that she's moderated for the forum today, this year. And the first was a panel called Women in the Arab Spring, and the second was called Tech Wadi, Building Bridges Between America and the Middle East. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Please welcome Dr. Dina Ibrahim.
Thank you so very much to Celia Menschel. She is absolutely wonderful. And thank you to all of her efforts organizing these wonderful talks at the Middle East Forum. So I do want to remind you guys again that the books are on sale outside. I did read Dr. Hendrickson's book, and it is fascinating. I do urge you to pick up a copy. And let's go ahead and get started. Thank you all for being here today. Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dr. Dina Ibrahim, Associate Professor of Broadcast and Communication Arts at San Francisco State University. I'll be your host for today's program, America and the Rogue States. We also welcome our radio and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Thomas Hendrickson. Dr. Henriksen is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, where he focuses on American foreign policy, international political affairs, and insurgencies. He specializes in the study of U.S. diplomatic and military courses of action toward terrorist havens in the non-Western world and toward rogue regimes. Dr. Henriksen's most recent volume, published earlier this year, is called America and the Rogue States. It analyzes Washington's interactions with Iran, North Korea, and other rogue nations since the Cold War. We are honored to have him with us.
Thank you very much, Dr. Abraham, and thank all of you for coming, and I'm especially appreciative of the Commonwealth Club and Cecilia Menschel's help in organizing this event. Rogue states have been with us for a long, long time. And one of the things, what I wanted to do in the book, and there's an opening chapter, dealing with rogue states in the past. And we've had rogue states from time out of mind. These are states that are defined slightly differently than we define states today. Obviously, they didn't have nuclear weapons or chemical weapons back 2,000 years ago, but they did act as outlier states. These are states that didn't conform, didn't want alliances, and many times were, in fact, piracies, were pirate states. I'll give you a state that was not a rogue state, but sometimes people say, well, it did stand outside the international system. This is back in the times of classical Greeks. So there's a little tiny island called Milos. Thucydides writes about it. Well, Milos tried to stay outside the Athenian orbit. It wanted to stay away from Athens. It may have had slightly good relations with Sparta, but it wanted to stay out of the Peloponnesian War. But the Athenians wouldn't have it, so they invaded it, crushed it, destroyed it, killed all the military-age men, and sold the women and children into slavery, as was the course of action in those days. But Milos was not a rogue state, just as Finland in the 1950s and 60s was not a rogue state because it didn't want to be joined to the Soviet Union. It stood apart from the Soviet Union. The idea of rogue states are states that really cause their neighbors a great deal of grief because of their own actions. There were states that did this during the period of classical Rome in the Mediterranean that stood aside, but that fostered piracy. There was one located in what is contemporary Turkey today. It was finally crushed by none other than a very famous Roman general by the name of Pompey, who himself was assassinated in Egypt years later. But our own brush with rogue states in a more contemporary period, not modern, but more contemporary period than this, was, in fact, the states across North Africa. These were the so-called Barbary states. At the very early days of the American Republic, for example, these states preyed on shipping in the Mediterranean, not just American shipping, but English shipping, the Dutch, of course, and they also invaded the coast of the Mediterranean countries, of Italy, of France, and Spain, and they would seize people off the coast and take them. The women were sold into harems. The men were put to work. So there was a kind of piracy that infected from these Barbary states in places that we know today as Tunisia, the city of Tripoli, Morocco, Algiers, and so forth. There were a number of these. They were really breakaway states from the Ottoman Empire, which had been established earlier across North Africa, Egypt included, of course, been held by the Ottoman Empire. And these states were breakaway states that engaged in piracy throughout the period of the early American Republic. It wasn't until President Jefferson and then Madison that the United States took a strong course of action. Now, these states were open to bribes as modern-day rogue states. And as a consequence, it's hard to believe that America paid tribute to these Barbary states. In fact, 20% of our budget in these early years, this very early 19th century, was devoted to tribute to these states. And finally, the United States said, this is enough, and we began to bombard them, attack them, and finally we signed certain agreements with them, which ended their piracy toward us. What really ended the rogue states, of course, was a conquest by the Italians and the French of North Africa and held those states. That suppressed it. A more modern-day version of piracy, of course, is Somalia, which we can talk a little bit about in the question-answer period. But Somalia is not a rogue state. Now, what do I mean by rogue states in a contemporary setting, in today's setting? Roughly, it goes like this. My criteria and the criteria of the State Department is that these are states that are non-democracies. They're extremely brutal to their own citizens. They suppress them. On top of that, they export terrorism. They disrupt their neighbors. And finally and crucially, they try to manufacture weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear weapons. Not just chemical weapons or biological weapons, but nuclear weapons is the one that really grabs attention from the outside world. Now, let me go back and say, where do these contemporary rogue states come from? In the book, I emphasized Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. But there are other states that are considered rogue states. Sometimes people consider states like Cuba. At one time, Libya was a rogue state. Syria certainly was a rogue state and is a rogue state. These are states in a contemporary setting. Where did they come from? How did we have to wrestle with them? Well, I'm one of those people always tried to see a little different slant of the world. And one of the interpretations we have of the period after the Cold War was that the Soviet Union collapsed somewhat benignly. I mean, there wasn't much bloodshed. Most of the bloodshed committed by the Soviet Union was done in the Stalin era with forced collectivization of the farms, with suppression of minorities, with the transference of certain peoples from certain regions to other regions, by prison camps, by gulags, and so on. But the aftermath was the Soviet Union went down more of a whimper than a bang. And not many people were killed. Some were killed in Latvia. Some were killed in Central Asia. But it was relatively and unexpectedly a mild collapse. And so people say, well, we got away free. Well, not quite. Because the Soviet Union was responsible, if not creating the number of rogue states we deal with today, certainly being an aider and abettor and providing them with military arms and, in some cases, nuclear capability. Let me go through just a few of these with you to show what I mean. The Soviet Union had client states, states that helped it. Remember, the Soviet Union and the United States were locked in this titanic duel competition from the late 1940s forward. It had a certain predictability to Cold War. There were certain times when things did get out of hand, and one of those, as some of you remember or studied, that the United States came to the brink of a nuclear war in 1962 with the Cuban Missile Crisis. After that, both sides realized that it was a bad idea to go head-to-head against each other. Things get out of hand. But that doesn't mean that both sides didn't have client states. The Soviet Union had a number of states in Eastern Europe that were captive, so-called captive nations, Poland, Hungary, the Czechoslovakia, and so on. And the United States, of course, we had our allies. And both countries dealt with allies that were unsavory at times. We used the Duvaliers, for example, in Haiti. It was a brutal dictatorship, but they were anti-communist. We backed up Mobutu in the Congo, who was also a brutal leader, but he too was anti-communist. These were our kind of satellites. Not all our satellites were bad. Not all were Mobutus or Duvaliers. And along the Soviet side, they too had their satellites. And among those satellites are states they tried to use against the United States in a sort of proxy war were places like North Korea, places like Iraq, and Syria and Libya. These were the so-called revolutionary states of the Middle East, states that were rejectionist toward Israel, but states also that did export terrorism, opened their borders to terrorists, and helped sponsor terrorism against the United States. This was a distraction for us, cost a lot of money. A lot of time was gone. And the Soviet Union did not want to have a direct confrontation of the United States and the Mediterranean, so proxy states were useful. And so big powers often use smaller states as pawns in their duel with each other. It was safer. There was a little plausible deniability. And nonetheless, these were the states that came to represent rogue states for us. These states, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, these states were thrown up on the international scene without the same kind of support system they had enjoyed before. Probably the most striking example of this is North Korea. North Korea was an ally, a close ally, of the Soviet Union. It's now more aligned with China. But during the 1950s and the 60s and 70s and so on, throughout the Cold War period, North Korea was aligned. The same might be said, I think, of Syria to a degree, Libya, Iraq. Now, nowhere in the book, in my mind today, were these states robots. They had their own policies. And sometimes they did things the Soviets didn't want them to do. But they depended on the Soviet Union for military aid, sometimes financial aid, and specialized training. Now, the idea of terrorism is an old idea, and I don't want to misinform anyone or give you the impression, but I think terrorism was invented by the Soviet Union. It wasn't. It was used before. But what the Soviets did, they believed in terrorism as a useful instrument of state policy. In fact, Trotsky, none other than Trotsky, wrote a book called Terrorism and Communism, which showed how to use terrorist methods and promotion of political agenda. Now, states have always done that to a degree. There's been assassinations all through history and attempts to use terror to confound your enemies. But the Soviets put it on a bureaucratic level and systematized it in a way that no modern state has used before. And I think in some sense this was passed on to certain rogue states that used it. Because their officials were trained in the Soviet Union or in Eastern Europe by the East Germans in some respects, how to use terror as an instrument of policy. And so this carried over into some of these rogue states. The exception to this kind of picture I'm painting, where we have proxy states of a Soviet Union that depended on Moscow for arms or for training, for money, is, of course, Iran. Iran was never a proxy state of the Soviet Union. But this is, to me, the modern origins of proxy states, of these rogue states. And that's how we get them. The world bequeathed this. These states to us with the collapse of Soviet Union, because these states, when the Soviet Union collapsed, no longer had that tie, no longer had that support mechanisms. It's as if their umbilical cord had been cut. They were up on their own. Now, the most dramatic examples of that, of course, in North Korea again, and Iraq. Those are the two states that really pressed the envelope. Syria was never in the same league. Iran always had its own agenda, not necessarily the agenda of the Soviet Union. It had its own agenda and was not so easily moved. So that's the beginning of the rogue era. That's where it comes from. The Soviets have a lot to do with it. Now, I'm going to go through and say a little bit about Iran, Iraq, and North Korea just very, very quickly, and then something generally about the others. This is only a tiny sketch. In the case of Iraq, Iraq was a quintessential rogue state. It engaged in warfare against Iran from 1980 to 1988. A couple years later, it invaded Kuwait. It manufactured weapons of mass destruction, nuclear capability, which was pretty well cleaned out at the end of the Gulf War, the first Persian Gulf War in 1991. They had built nuclear reactors, some were French aid. They had a capacity to export terrorism. They sponsored terrorism whenever they could. And as a consequence, they were a very dangerous state. However, as we all know, they did not have nuclear weapons in 2003. They had blueprints, yes, and they may have gone and got nuclear weapons had they been left alone and managed to throw off the sanctions. but they didn't have them. So the Bush administration made a huge error in calculating the attack on Iran based on nuclear weapons. He was an unsavory leader, no doubt. He might have been overthrown in the Arab Spring had he lived, had we not invaded. But the point is, we did not have nuclear weapons in Iraq. That was a mistake. And one, I don't know, it may work out in the long run. We'll have to see 20, 30 years more if that works. If Iraq doesn't, in fact, collapse into some sort of state of anarchy. It also, the Iraq War, as everybody knows, removed a very strong counterpoint to Iran. In fact, one of the things that Saddam Hussein did very well, he was a consummate bluffer. He bluffed so much about having nuclear weapons that even the United States believed him, and other intelligence services as well, the British, the Germans, and so forth. So nonetheless, this is one of the rogue states, one of the quintessential rogue states of the period that is no longer a rogue state today. It is a kind of wobbly democracy dominated by one group, the Shiite in Iraq, and it may, in fact, disintegrate. If present trends continue and intensify, it could, in fact, dissolve into something like a mid-eastern Yugoslavia, which also disintegrated in the 1990s, as you know, into several small states. Thereupon, so just saying that is one of the ingredients of this whole war. Saddam Hussein was also not as wily or as clever as the North Koreans or the Iranians. They would sometimes walk up to the red line, but they wouldn't cross it. They'd back down, or they'd divert, or something would do it. They would pull back just enough. Or they were also in a better position in conventional arms than was, in fact, Iraq at the time of invasion. They were much better grounded, much more wily, more clever, and somehow played the United States off against others. And I can happy to go into that in some detail. Now, moving on, just to say just a little bit about Iran, and we can come back to this in the discussion period, because Iran, of course, is on everybody's watch list now with a movement toward some form of nuclear capacity, weapons capacity perhaps, and it's building. The Iranian relationship is probably in some ways the most unfortunate of these states because, as I indicated earlier, Iran never was a surrogate of Moscow. Iran was, in fact, a very conscious state of its own destiny, its own language, its own history, in a way that these other states were recently created in the Middle East. I mean, Syria, Iraq, Transjordan, these were all created after World War I. They were just recent states. Persia is an ancient empire, a very proud empire that even defeated Roman armies in classical times. It's a state that had a certain hegemony, a literature, a great capacity, and also was, in fact, was more than just a little bit apprehensive of Russia or the Soviet Union. It was against it. The reason it was against it was they always knew that the Russians had designs on their territory, particularly the northern part of Iran. Both in World War I and in World War II, the Russians invaded and held territory in northern Iran. That was one reason. And since the times of Catherine the Great, this great German figure who managed to get to the top of Tsardom in Russia, had designs. She had designs on a warm water port. There was always this southern thrush, rush of the Russians throughout the 18th and 19th century, in which they took over Central Asia as well as into Siberia. They were always threatening the Iranians. And finally, and not unimportantly, communism is atheistic. And this offended the sensibilities of the leaders of Persia, who are, in fact, religious figures as well as political figures. So they are offended by the atheism of a government in Moscow. For those reasons, Iran was never, in fact, a surrogate state of the Soviet Union. It did get arms from time to time later on, but as you know, it was actually a very close ally of the United States. In fact, when Woodrow Wilson made his dramatic statements during World War I and afterwards about democracy and nations having a right to self-determination, That struck a responsive chord in Persian intellectuals. This is something they wanted to hear. The United States often stuck up for Persia after World War II by it was anti-colonial. Americans didn't go into World War II to pull British chestnuts out of the fire. They didn't agree with Britain on this idea that they were going to save the British Empire. And so there was this anti-colonial feeling that ran through the course of American policy. These were all popular within Iran itself. And also the fact is the Iranians' duel was really with the British and their Anglo-Persian oil, which had really begins in Iran at the very beginning of the 20th century, 1907. This is where their animosities were directed towards. So we started off not in too bad a shape with Persia. As you know, we did back the Shah. There was this famous attempt to get rid of the Shah by Mossadegh, and the fact the Shah was on a defensive, and Mossadegh was overthrown by the Iranian military in 1953, and the Iranians to this day blame us. Now, I looked into this fairly carefully, this famous coup, because the Iranians denounce us and still say we were instrumental in overthrowing Mossadegh. Well, let me say this. The Iranians need a foreign devil. They need a foreign demon. America's role was pretty slender. Oh, yes, we may have provided some money. There were CIA types in Tehran at the time. And the money, the figures are all over the place, $10 million, maybe 20. But if anyone really thinks the military needs lessons from the CIA how to stage a coup, they don't know much about coups. Coups in non-Western countries are relatively easy to stage. In fact, there was a famous scholar who wrote a handbook, how to do a coup in a third world country. It was almost a cartoon book because it was so simplistic. It was a classic that came out in the 1970s. And on one picture, you take over the presidential palace with tanks. You do the same thing at General Post Office, a broadcasting system, and a few other government buildings. You've got the country. Now, you can't stage a coup in a country like the United States or Western democracies. It won't work. But in these tiny countries where there aren't many symbols or actually nexus of power, it's pretty easy. So no one had to teach Iranian generals to do that. They could do it themselves. And the other couple points. One, throwing out Mossadegh was not unpopular among a lot of Iranian people. They wanted it. The Bazaris didn't like what Mossadegh had in mind. And finally, Mossadegh was aligned with the Two-Day Party. The Two-Day Party was a communist party. Again, the atheism. The coup against Mossadegh was pretty popular among Iranian clerics. They didn't like him. The clergy didn't like him. So I think it's a little overblown. But nonetheless, it doesn't make any difference. If somebody believes something, it doesn't matter if it's true or not. It's real. And so the Iranian people, or large elements of them, believe the United States interfered in 1953 and took over and helped this coup. That's all that matters. That's reality for them. It's used very effectively as a cohesive element to build nationalism in Iran against the United States. We are the great Satan. But once that happened, it did poison the well. Finally, when the Shah was overthrown in 1979, the Shah went from being kind of Iran went from kind of being an outpost of America, particularly under Nixon, in the Nixon Doctrine after the Vietnam War was going down. The United States was looking for ways to pull back. And so if a Shah could police the Persian Gulf, all the better. But after the Shah was overthrown and the Ayatollahs came in 1979, Iran overnight went from friend to implacable enemy of the United States. And since that day, we've been across swords with Iran. And in many ways, Iranians, as I said, have their own agenda, which is a sort of domination or at least a presence in the Persian Gulf, a stretching of among their co-religious groups in places like Iraq, in Syria to a degree, and mostly in Lebanon, this so-called Shiite crescent. There's a fervoring of this. And, of course, an enormous animosity toward Israel. So Iran stands out a little bit different. The Iranians have a very educated population, technologically sophisticated. Many of them trained at American or West European universities back in the 1970s and afterwards. And so consequently, the ability to build a nuclear weapon is a real possibility in Iranian society, as is building missiles that can carry satellites into orbit. So the Iranians are no sloughs when it comes to technology or science itself. They have the capacity. But Iran, of course, has its own agenda against the United States. It's going to and so we're faced with this very difficult situation of what do we do in the world with one more nuclear power, which in fact could create more nuclear powers in the Middle East region. If Saudi Arabia or Egypt or any other country decides that they want a nuclear weapon, we have this Shiite-Sunni split. Things could get very, very tense. And are already over tense region. So let me stop there and just move on to final main country that I covered in this in the book, and that's North Korea. North Korea was in fact a very close satellite of the Soviet Union, and this was done because the North Koreans again are no sloughs at diplomacy. They understood that their greatest border and their greatest fear was domination from China. China invaded Korea for centuries. Some invasions were minor, some invasions were major. But nonetheless, there is this tension between the North Koreans, or just all Koreans, and China. China is a major power. It is the 800-pound gorilla. And North Koreans realize that. And so they wanted an alliance with a country that was a little safer. They do share a border with Russia. It's only about 100 miles long. But nonetheless, Russia was not a threat, a territorial threat the same way China was. So this was a relationship. After the Korean War divided the peninsula between North and South and ended in 1953, the North Koreans almost immediately wanted their own nuclear capacity. They understood the importance of nuclear weapons, partly because of Hiroshima, partly because the United States may have threatened China with nuclear weapons unless they stopped helping the North Koreans during the Korean War. For whatever reasons, they realized they were an important dimension of power and of regime preservation. So they wanted it. And the Soviets obliged them by giving them a small nuclear reactor in the late 1950s, in which they've used ever since that time. But they, after the Soviet Union collapsed, they were tossed on their own. And they began to develop and further these. They no longer were restrained by the Soviet Union. And the Soviets did restrain them. The Soviet Union forced them to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1985 and ratify it. They did that because the Soviets said, you're not getting anything more from us unless you do it. And they did it. This is one of many agreements they signed and broke. But nonetheless, they did sign it. The Soviets did exercise a certain restraint over North Korea. Once the Soviet Union was gone, once they could no longer provide largesse and support, the North Koreans were cast up on the international scene alone, along with Iraq, along with so many other states. And they became kind of international bad boys. They did anything they could to kind of offend America, not because they just wanted to offend America, but because they use this as a way of maintaining power. The leadership understands they're not elected. They don't have legitimacy. They're not hereditary rulers in the sense of the European monarchs. So you need something that glue makes you stick. And so you need these foreign devils. And so the United States was a convenient foreign devil. It was a world power. It was sometimes ambivalent. It was wishy-washy. It made mistakes. It was weak at times. It was willing to buy people off. It wasn't a particularly convincing power at times. Sometimes it would be very convincing, very nasty power when it wanted to. But other times it sort of was ambivalent. And so it was a perfect enemy. And also the United States has a lot of problems. So it's easy to sort of kick the United States in the shins once in a while and get some attention and just leave it alone. This was a North Korean attitude. So they began to cozy up a little more to the Chinese because of necessity, but they also, in a bizarre way, reached out to us. And they reached out in a way that it was hard to imagine. When people are nice to us, we think they're reaching out to us. North Koreans did the reverse. They did something mean and expected us to reciprocate, and sometimes we did. Sometimes we were very generous. try to bite them off, try to say, well, what do you want? If you'll behave yourself, we'll give you this. We'll reward your bad behavior, but please don't do it again. That was our attitude toward North Korea. So these were the quintessential rogue states. We're also in a predicament with North Korea. North Korea, for all its nuclear capacity, and it's again, cloudy, it's not as firm, they're not as technologically sophisticated as are the Iranians. They do have smart engineers, they can do things, they can launch rockets, particularly small rockets that could travel, or missiles that will travel 200 or 300 miles, but they don't have the same capabilities of the Iranians. They are nonetheless a problem for the region because they keep it in uproar and destabilize it. They also have a very strong conventional army across the DMZ, which is a strip between North and South Korea, which is a demilitarized zone. It's about 2 miles wide. But nonetheless, on either side, it's the most heavily fortified border in the world. And there's a real concern that the North Koreans could launch conventional rockets, conventional artillery shells, onto Seoul, Korea, which is only about 35 miles south of the DMZ. So it has this also conventional capability. So it keeps the world uneven. Now, the good news is, and I think many of you probably know this, we have a new ruler, Kim Jong-un, who's now in power, and Kim Jong-un is a younger man, probably about 30, and he seems to be making some very slight but nonetheless noticeable changes in North Korea. And so consequently, we may have a new North Korea. We may get one that is not so much a threat. We don't know that for sure. We may get one that tries to modernize along the lines of Deng Xiaoping and China. And may try to change society. That would be good news, so we'll just have to stay tuned. Now, let me just turn quickly and say something about some of the other rogue states. These states came about like the principal rogue states because they were placed on the State Department's list of terror states starting in 1979. There was a legislation passed in the U.S. Congress that demanded that the State Department produce an annual list of terror states, later terrorist organizations, and finally terrorist individuals. But just stick with the states. The early states, of course, were places like North Korea, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, even the Sudan and Cuba. We don't think of Cuba. We don't think of it as a rogue state anymore. But at one time, Cuba performed a role of Hessians in the Soviet Union's empire. They were the spear point, not only by spreading subversion in Latin America, but also they actually invaded Angola. There was almost 20,000 Cuban troops in Angola in the 1970s trying to end that civil war between the Marxist MPLA and the other UNITA and other forces in this huge war that was more tribal than actually ideological. But the Cubans did enter and send ground troops. They were the foremost at spreading trouble for the United States and for democratic governments in Latin America in the 1970s, 80s. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Cuba went with them. Cuba got enormous subsidies from the Soviet Union. Cuba is not a rogue state today. Cuba is, in fact, a state that's slowly, slowly moving in a different direction, but it's not a rogue state. The only one that really thinks it's a kind of socialist state is, of course, Chavez. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. He looks upon Cuba a little bit the way the Greeks looked, or the Romans looked upon the Greeks. These are classics. So Chavez looks upon them as what socialism should look like or used to look like, and Chavez is a populist, and he kind of wants to be the same way. People ask me, do I think Venezuela is a rogue state? I say no. It hasn't made nuclear weapons. It has entered in a contract with Russia for some nuclear capacity, but nothing's really happened. It does have fairly good relationships with Iran, and Iran does cause problems or is considered to be causing problems in Latin America. But still, I don't think Venezuela has stepped over that line. A couple more states. Sudan at one time was a Mecca, a homeland, a base for all kinds of terrorists. Even Osama bin Laden was there for a time. Carlos Jaco, the very famous terrorist, now about to go on trial in France. He was in Sudan for a while. The Sudanese turned him over to the French. they began to move away from, they told Osama bin Laden to leave. He left in 1996 and he went back to Afghanistan. Sudan is a failed state. It's not that it's not brutal to its own people. It is. In fact, it's split. There's now a North Sudan and a South Sudan. But it's no longer, in my estimation, a real rogue state. Let's just consider quickly Libya. Libya was, one of the most interesting states because Gaddafi went out of the cold and became transformed his state into a dictatorship, but no longer a rogue state because he opened it up to weapons inspectors. A state like another state that's interesting, not a rogue state, is Myanmar. Some people said Myanmar was on its road to be part of the, a rogue state. Myanmar has switched around. So that brings me to the end of, and I'd like to have your questions, but I want to leave you with two points. One, rogue states are extremely transient in history. They don't last. For one reason or another, they go down. And we've seen that in the case of places like Libya. We're about to see it in Syria. We saw it with Iraq. They don't last long. In the history, the sweep of history, they're not like regular states, conventional states. The next point is, and finally, is that rogue states of the 1990s are, in fact, no longer footloose and fancy as they were. North Korea has warmed up to China. In the case of Iran, Iran looks a little bit to Russia and also to China to run certain diplomatic interference for it. Syria is, in fact, a dependency on Iran and on Hezbollah. It's not in the same rogue category. So even rogue states have had to make alignments and readjustments because of the new world that we're facing. And so with that, I think it's a different kind of rogue state we face, one that is not the same as it was at the beginning of the period of the late 1990s when the Soviet, after the Soviet Union collapsed and these states were free. So why don't I end on that happy note and take your questions or comments. And thank you very much for listening.
Thanks to Dr. Thomas Henriksen of the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and author of America and the Rogue States. So now it's time for the question and answer period. I have quite a few questions here for you. Going back to the beginning of your talk, what effect did the U.S. Marines have in ending Barbary Coast piracy compared to the English and Italian efforts, as you mentioned?
Well, as you know, the Marine Corps hymn from the shores of Tripoli to the halls of Montezuma takes its name in part from the engagement of Tripoli. The attacks that the Marines and the American Navy under such people as Stephen Decatur and others were really punitive attacks. They did attack. They did burn ships or attack ships in the Barbary harbors. They did set them back on their heels, but there was no modern-day nation-building. We didn't invade. We didn't build states. We didn't try to change anybody's behavior beyond just we signed, America signed treaties with these, and in fact, it did curtail. It did end it because the various leaders there were afraid that more dire consequences would be visited upon them by the Marines and by the other forces. And so consequently, it did. The point about the final change comes about with the Italians invading and the French invading and taking over North Africa and holding it and putting on a modicum of kind of westernization on those states that changed things. I mean, it wasn't always, it was sometimes brutal rule, there was suppression, but there was also the reverse side of that, there was modernization attempted. That is to say, telegraphs were built, roads were built, children went to school, certain stability took place, and there was an educated class fostered in those countries because of the European colonialism. And so that really, in fact, changed the states dramatically. Now, in fact, as you know, the Italians pulled out or were forced out during World War II, and the French surrendered most of the territories in North Africa peaceably, except for Algeria, which in, the French considered part of French soil and fought a very, very bitter anti-colonial war there, which they in turn lost politically, not military, but politically. I hope that answered the question.
Moving on to North Korea, the people of North Korea are starving. How can the government ignore that fact?
These sort of totalitarian governments are extremely insulated from the people. They don't care about them. It's hard for us because we live in a country where if we see somebody poor, we'll help. The government, we expect to help them. If there's an earthquake or hurricane, we expect our government to go in and feed people. They provide medical care and kind of transform. They don't have the same. They have a contempt for the lower class people. They actually dislike them. They don't care. They're peasants to them. They're worse than peasants. They smell. They have broken teeth. They don't care. These people are just beneath them. And so consequently, they're on the other side of that is the fact they want to hang on to power. And so they have no tolerance. They don't care. And so the government has had this problem. They almost had biblical floods and biblical dry periods or droughts in Korea in the 1990s. And we don't know exactly how many people died, but lots and lots died. And it was because of government. The government didn't care. The government didn't intervene. Now, they're not the only ones. In European history, plenty of examples where governments behave the same way. So it's not it's not just Asians. It's a kind of mental set that goes with the totalitarian rule or monarchical rule that people on the bottom don't count. But the government is impervious to that sort of feeling. Now, that may change as more people get cell phones, as people kind of things loosen up. But they have a grip on power, a grip that controls the propaganda, that controls any sort of outlets. And they have a very brutal police system in which we're not sure. Somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 people are imprisoned in almost unbelievable conditions, medieval conditions, or worse than medieval conditions, in these various gulags. And there have been a few books about this by people who somehow managed to escape. But it's a very repressive system. And one should keep us up at night worrying about or thinking about what's going on there, and we don't do enough to end it.
We'd like to remind our radio audience this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California and that you're listening to America and the Rogue States with Dr. Thomas Hendrickson of the Hoover Institution. There are a couple questions here about Syria. I'll just go ahead and combine them. The first is, and you've definitely addressed this, but is Syria a rogue state? That's a direct question. And then a follow-up to that is Syria today is supported by Russia and China. In your opinion, what would it take for Russia and China to pull back from support of Assad?
Okay, those are both good questions. the case I considered Syria a rogue state because it's a repressive government, but it did sponsor a lot of terrorism for a while. But the last 20 years or so, it hasn't sponsored much terrorism outside of Lebanon and occasionally of Israel. But for a while, it was actually spreading terrorism in Western Europe, but it decided that it couldn't do this any longer. Nonetheless, it has one of the largest stocks of chemical weapons in the world. It did this on its own, partly because I think it suffered so many defeats of Israel. They thought they had to have something, military defeats, that is, in conventional wars, that they had to have something that they thought could redress their balance. And finally, they did attempt, so far as we know, to build a nuclear reactor with the cooperation of the North Koreans. And that we pretty well documented from Korean ships coming in. And the site that was blown up in northeastern Syria by the Israelis in 2006 was in fact modeled on Yongbyon, which is Yongbyon is the North Korean nuclear reactor. So for those reasons, sponsorship of terrorism, nuclear reactor, repressive government, I classified it as a rogue state. So the second question dealing with what it will take for China and Russia to back off, I think there's several reasons they probably won't. Partly because both states, particularly the Russians who are taking the lead in this, under Putin, has seen a more antagonistic relationship with the United States. As you know, many Russian citizens are resentful of the fact that their empire collapsed, that the Americans are now the only sole superpower, at least for a while, and so there's a resentment that Vladimir Putin, the leader of Russia, can harness and use for his own designs, again, for his own legitimacy, for his own policies. So he can do this. Also, I think there's a certain feeling that the Russians want to stop any kind of religious fervor because they themselves are at risk, their own sovereign provinces. I know everybody's busy. We don't have a lot of time to spend. But there's actually a raging insurgency going on in the Caucasus today of various forces in Dagestan and Chechnya and so on. That almost daily, policemen and militants are being killed. This is going on. Sort of, the Russians are extremely conscious of this. In fact, they don't want us to pull out of Afghanistan because they're worried that this contagion will move northward into the Caucasus, into Central Asia, and it's going to cause them problems. So I think that is their kind of political reason for seeing that Assad represents a counter to this. Assad is not that. He may be a brutal man. He may not be somebody you want to spend time with, but nonetheless, he's their guy on this issue. And he by keeping the cork in the bottle so it doesn't explode, he is, in fact, useful. So I think there's the ideological reason against the United States and the self-interested reason of supporting Assad. And also the fact that the Russians want a certain port, Latakia. They've had some small base in the Mediterranean, so they get to be a Mediterranean power, so to speak, or at least a player in the Mediterranean. So there are really three big reasons.
And the a major topic here, of course, is Israel and Iran. So there are a couple of questions related to that. I'll read them out to you. Point blank, should Israel bomb Iran? Wouldn't it bring about a terrible wider war, which could lead to a world war?
Every time we talk about bombing somebody, I have to tell you a story. And this story takes place 1940s in London with a blitz. You know, you can picture the dark sky, the searchlights penetrating, the Germans, the Luftwaffe bombing London. And this old woman goes up to the air raid ward and she says, you know, one thing about these bombs, they sure take your mind off the war. Well, that's my problem. If we bomb or get dragged into bombing Iran, I have no doubt the American military will win that contest. We will beat them. This is what we do best. We do conventional wars. If you look at World War II, they bet they should realize we will bomb them back to the Stone Age if we have to. It might take 3 months, but we'll do it. Between cruise missiles and bombings, and we will sink their fleets. That will all happen. But what worries me, what happens next? What if there's an upsurge of an Iran against the protest movement, the Green Movement, but protest in 2009 and was serious? What happens if that takes place? Do we leave those people to be savaged and killed like we're doing in Syria? Are we just going to let that happen? We can't. We can't walk away from it. So that means we have to intervene. I can't imagine the American people wanting another Middle Eastern war. I don't think this government, the administration currently in power, if it is reelected, will want to do that. I don't think their heart's in it. And they're reflecting American sentiments in many respects. I don't think America wants to get dragged into that kind of war again, because that would mean an occupation. And don't forget that Iran is three times the size in population that Iraq was. Iraq was roughly 25,000, 28,000, depending on who does accounting. Iran is 70 million. 25 million are in Iraq, and roughly 70 million in Iraq. It's a much bigger country. Their religious fervor would be enormous to see, again, an outside army coming in. I'm sure that would be a very brutal campaign and a very long one to suppress it. And yet we would have an obligation, I think. So that's something I'm very concerned about. We couldn't. It would be. I think again we'd win, but it'd be such a terrible loss. It'd be a Pyrrhic victory in both blood and treasure, and I'm not sure the American people would stand for it.
So your opinion regarding Israel's threat to use force in an attempt to eliminate Iran's development of nuclear weapons?
Well, the Israelis might do it, but again, it's unclear to me if even Benjamin Netanyahu has a wide support from Israel. It seems to be there's a lot of division among the Israeli people about getting into this war, and some of the even some of the former Israeli military officials and intelligence officials saying don't do it. So it's unclear that to me that if Israel will do it, if they don't think they have American support. And it is worrisome, no doubt. I mean, we certainly sympathize with the Israelis, with the threats that the Iranian officials have made about wiping Israel off the map and so on. And the fact is, if Iran gets a bomb, we know it's going to lead to proliferation in the region. There's no doubt that other states in the region will want nuclear capacity as a balance of terror. So it's not going to be pleasant. So we're all hopeful that something will fall out of the sky, but I'm not too optimistic. But the crucial point may come this coming summer, whatever governments in power in the United States, that some feel that the Iranians will cross the so-called red line and have a certain nuclear capacity by July of 2013. Other people say, well, that's not really true. They'll still have, there'll be other steps they have to do. But certainly this is not a problem that's going to go away.
Is Obama doing the right thing by relying so heavily on diplomacy?
Well, to be fair, I mean, Obama came in with, I think, somewhat unrealistic expectations that he could talk to the Iranians into this, a change. I mean, he did make the speech in Cairo, which was, I think, a genuine effort on his part to reach out. It didn't work. The Iranians didn't want to do it. They carried on. To be fair, I think the Obama administration has increased the sanctions dramatically. I mean, much more than his predecessor did. There was an enormous step up in sanctions. Sanctions are not, they don't really change governments. That's a problem. What else can you do? I mean, we have used sanctions around the world. They're hard on economies. People die from malnutrition. Many, many Iraqis died from sanctions we imposed on Iraq because of malnutrition, because of lack of food stuff. Of course, the government did siphon off money to build palaces, but in the popular press, we were at fault, and the Western world was at fault for imposing those sanctions. The sanctions will do a lot of harm to Iran, but whether, in fact, it will somewhat unify them, too, as it did in Iraq against foreigners. So I'm not sure that sanctions are gonna do it. I'm doubtful. And so we're going to have a crisis down the road, whether it's next summer or thereafter. There will be at some point where something could be some trigger that will enter us into a war. That's the pessimistic assessment that I can make at this time.
Are you concerned that the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamists are gaining control in many countries taken over during the Arab Spring from dictators and U.S. allies?
Well, these governments that have replaced dictators, we all have our fingers crossed that there'll be moderate Islamicists, that they may institute some minor reforms. They may move against corruption. But in the last fact, in the last analysis, they still have to feed people, and they still have to get economies running. So they're under the gun, so to speak. They can have as many foreign devils as they want, but they have to make these economies run. And with the fact is that in the Islamic world, unlike North Korea, you do have a healthy internet. You do have, in fact, a communications in place. So these people know something about the outside world, and they have aspirations for change and better lives. So I'm guardedly optimistic, though I'm certainly concerned in the short term. But looking upon the evolution of democracy in the Western world, how it took centuries, we still have to take a sort of somewhat long view of what might happen. And we have to help when we can, but not too much, because we're still the outsider. We can train people. We can have them here to this country and teach them how to be doctors or how to be scientists and send them home. We can do all those things to help. But on the other hand, in the last analysis, it's their country and it's their way of doing things. So we can only do so much. We can provide some minor foreign aid. But again, this country cannot do it in the way it did in the past because it simply no longer has the resources to do so. So to sum up, just say that, yes, I'm guardedly optimistic, but certainly day to day, it's a very bumpy road to watch what's going on in parts of the Middle East.
Unfortunately, we have time for only one last question. And this is back to North Korea now. If President Bush had not denigrated the Korean leader in 2001, would history have been better served? There's a note here that he called him a short pipsqueak.
Leaders from all countries are always denigrating other leaders. That's nothing. I mean, the North Koreans have called us much worse over the period of time, and they have a very, very almost, it's cliche in a sense in the Soviet period, but a very colorful language to characterize the United States. But when it comes down to wanting to deal with us, they will. So I'm not sure that President Bush's comments are the fact, the last word. There were many other things. On the other hand, Bush did take North Korea off the terrorist list, which many, many people oppose. So I suppose he made up for it in some respects by taking North Korea off the terrorist list. But I don't think it was that crucial remark that would set back negotiations, because as I say, both countries do engage in a lot of hyperbole and a lot of criticism on each other. So I don't think the North Korean leader was that thin-skinned to take that kind of offense that would shut down negotiations.
Our thanks to Dr. Thomas Hendrickson, author of America and the Rogue States. We also thank our audiences here and those listening to the recording and on the internet. And now this meeting of the Club, Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 109 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
I'll stay around.